Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks, set the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day.
It is the 17th of August and this is episode 73. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. A bit of a different show. So usually there's going to be about, you know, 15 to 20 minutes of me and Pete bantering back and forth. We do the interviews and then 20 minutes at the end. Today we've got a bit of a different one. We've got a 54-minute interview with Douglas Murray. You guys might know him as the associate editor of The Spectator. He's a really cool thinker, also author of the new book, The Strange Death of Europe.
Yeah.
Pete and I sat down with him on Tuesday while he was in Melbourne for 54 minutes. We had this wide-ranging chat, identity politics, free speech, Europe, all of this really cool stuff. You guys are going to really enjoy it.
What we've gone with this week is less of me and James and more of an internationally acclaimed commentator.
Yeah.
So we're not sure how it's going to go. give us feedback.
The raucous cheers of most of our listeners. Yeah. There is going to be less of me and Pete this week. It's a really cool chat. I was listening back to it, editing it this morning. I sound a little unwell. there was one point in the interview where, like, I was so sick that my vision had completely blurred except for Douglas Murray's lips, which I was watching while he was speaking. I'm just like, this is a bad sign.
That's an internal story.
Maybe I was just captured. And then at the end when I was just like, he's like wrapping up, shaking all of our hands, and I'm just like, you don't want to shake my hand, I'm really sick. And he just started laughing over it. It was so clear he hadn't heard what I said. I'm just like, I got to shake that hand now.
So if you're sick, Douglas, we know why.
Sorry, it's me. Please feel free to sue me, but don't. Hopefully he's not listening. Cool. Well, let's talk about some stories. So big week for the IPA this week, and we're going to be talking to some of the people who are involved a bit later. We're going to be talking to the people who are involved in the stories next week. On the next week's episode, things will turn to dawn. We'll talk to Dan about his report and John about the thing. But let's talk about that report briefly now, Pete.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. So Dan Wild released a report earlier this week called Why Australia Must Exit the Paris Agreement. Now, this is a really great report and it's received a lot of play in the media. The report estimates that the Paris Climate Agreement emissions target will impose a $52 billion economic cost between 2018 and 2030. That equates to $8,566 per family in Australia. Now, that's $52 billion, could purchase 22 new hospitals.
That's a lot of hospitals.
That's a lot of money. And as Dan pointed out, the United States has exited the agreement. China is completely unconstrained by the agreement, and none of the EU nations are on track to meet their targets. This is irreparable economic damage without delivering an environmental dividend. And you have to think, you know, at this time where there's hundreds of thousands of people out of work, there's farmers struggling with high electricity costs, the kind of cost this is having.
Yeah, exactly. So because, like, when we signed up to Paris, there was always the agreement of, we're going to be hit economically, but, you know, there's this greater thing that we're working towards here and that's going to make it worth it. And so that's when, like, you know, when we've probably got listeners right now are like, you know, the Paris Agreement is still a good thing, or they might have friends who think the Paris Agreement is still a good thing. The point is, there's no country in the Paris Agreement that's actually sticking to it. That are making things better. Nothing, the US gone. China still emitting like crazy. Not a single country in the EU is holding up their end of the commitment.
Yeah, literally not a single one.
Yeah, so that's when it gets to the point of like, okay, well, let's really talk about what these economic costs are. And that's when, you know, you see stuff like $8,566 per family.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to give the money to the family, to be honest, rather than throwing it at this useless agreement.
It'll be interesting to see how my parents divvy that up, actually, because, you know, there is three of us. But the other thing that I enjoyed about this report, there's quite a distinctive cover. It's got this hellish inferno on the front, and I was there when Dan came down to our fantastic designer, Sammy Theron, and said, look, love your work here, Sammy. Can you just give me a bit more fire? Just a bit more fire, because he had a fire, but it wasn't fiery
enough. That is Dan Wild in a nutshell. Just a bit more fire and brimstone. Just a little bit more.
Check it out. Looks fantastic.
Yep. So that's available on our website. And as Pete said, there's a whole lot of media about it. So over on our SoundCloud page, and we linked to Win and Hay yesterday, you can listen to Dan on 2GB Breakfast with Alan Jones. Boy, oh boy. Did Alan Jones like that report?
Yes.
He found it so interesting. Mm-hmm. Dan could barely get a word out between Dan can barely get a word out between Alan Jones praising the report. So you can go listen to that. Dan's also been on TV. That's all on our Facebook page. And you can read the report and some of the coverage that it got on the IPA website.
Of course, Alan Jones read out Morgan Biggs. Hey, what did I miss the other week?
Yes, so Alan Jones is doing pretty well. and so is Morgan Begg. All right, so we'll get into the other one. So we're very happy here at the IPA. We've launched our...
We're
always happy at the IPA. Always happy with more fire. No, sorry. We've launched a new podcast. You guys might have seen an email about it. We've been talking about it on this show. The Great Books of Literature. This is going to be John Roskam, executive director here, who's been on the show. Andrew Bolt, Sky News presenter, also friend of the show. They are going to be talking about the 10 books that they feel are the 10 greatest books that have ever been written and the 10 books that mean the most to the Western canon and to themselves.
Different sort of vibe to what we've got going on here, James.
They're the great books great and ideas. We're the average podcast.
This is more...
They aim high, we aim low. Yeah. So that's basically, if you want the bit of an aim high flavor, you go over there. So first episode is going to be Bleak House. That is out on iTunes, Podbean, and through the IPA website. So either any of the ones that you want to listen to through there. Do so. Got up to number 2 in the charts on arts podcasts overnight. So after one episode, already number 2. So we're very happy about that. Very excited about that. Really great discussion. We recorded another one earlier this morning on Don Quixote. That's not going to be out for a few months. But yeah, the whole list is available on the website. So you guys are going to really enjoy that podcast.
And you don't have to have read the book to enjoy it.
You do not. I have not read Bleak House, but I was producing and I was asking a few questions. And I found the conversation really interesting and engaging. And hopefully you get to learn a bit more about Dickens and his life and maybe about Victorian literature. Mm. And you'll really appreciate that.
I've read 1 from 10 of that list.
Which one?
The Leopard. We had to read in year 11 lit. Mm. Mrs. Thompson, fantastic lit teacher, really brought us to life.
Well, brilliant. And hopefully then John and Andrew do in 2 weeks' time when the Leopard one comes out. Cool. So that's it for stories this week. We'll probably run through, because we've got this 54-minute interview, we don't want to keep our beloved listeners on too long.
Delay no more.
But we do have to do some delaying. So here's what else the IPAs have been up to this week. So a lot of our work this week has been based around the launch of Great Books and Dan's wonderful report. But we also have Matthew Lesh, who wrote an article in ABC Religion and Ethics talking about Tim Sudamasan and the exacerbation of race politics. So that's available on our website. You can go read that. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who, the second they see an article critical of Tim Sudamasan, they start clicking. So we've got one for you right there.
On the ABC.
On the ABC, no less. So you can go read that. Over on our Facebook page, there's a lot of Dan's media commitments about the report. And you can go through that. You've also got Gideon and Simon and a few of our other people on Sky News. So just scroll through and you can learn about the facts of the week. And that's all I've got. So thank you guys so much for listening to the podcast. Thank you so much for subscribing. We are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, Podbean, our website. So make sure you subscribe through any of the platforms that you want and make sure that you're telling your friends and family. So, you know, this podcast was only on iTunes for about a year. So you might have had people that you were trying to get into the podcast and they would say, I don't have iTunes. I don't have Apple Podcasts. I can't listen to it. So now they can go through Podbean and Spotify and they'll be able to listen to that. And yeah, if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you leave us a 5-star rating. So, you know, Dad and Roskam getting up to number 2 in the charts. They've laid down the gauntlet. Mm-hmm. Pete and I, we got to be better.
It's pretty soft, the art and culture chart, though, isn't it?
Well, I mean, let's talk about that.
Art and culture podcast.
So Gary Meehan's number 1 at the moment.
See,
so
there you go.
Yeah, we're up against Teacher's Pet, like the biggest podcast in the world right now.
Okay.
So cool. Let's talk about IPA memberships. So Nina pressing the buttons for us as always. If people want to become a member of the IPA, if they want to give us some financial support, where can they go?
Oh, just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click on that join button on the donations button if you decided to donate instead. And starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Brilliant. All right, let's go to that interview. Okay, we are now joined for the first time by Associate Editor of the Spectator magazine and author of the new book, The Strange Death of Europe, Immigration, Identity and Islam, Douglas Murray. Welcome to the show.
Great pleasure to be with you.
So you're in Australia on a bit of an all-star speaking tour with, you've got Majid Nawaz, Brett and Eric Weinstein and a lot of really interesting speakers. So what have your impressions of the tour been and the impressions of Australia?
Well, it's too early to tell and I've slept too little to have very distinct impressions so far, but it's been great. I did a long day-long conference on Sunday. It's now Tuesday. On Sunday, yes, I did a day-long conference with Brett and Eric Weinstein and Majid Nawaz, my fellow Brit, and also Sam Harris. And that was a terrific event. And then as of tonight here in Melbourne, I'm starting a set of 4 engagements with Dr. Cornel West, called the Polarized Tour, and we'll see how polarizing or otherwise it is. But that starts tonight in Melbourne, and then Sydney tomorrow, and then Auckland and then Brisbane. So I'm going to see a bit of your country, I hope.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. So many of your IPA members have seen you in Sydney. They've heard what you've said, and there's been the sort of elements of how politicians can't say anything meaningful anymore, just the way that political discourse is at the moment. Yeah. How do you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, firstly, I mean, I arrive at that conclusion from observation and just listening. I, for some years, as a writer and a journalist, been on many shows with politicians, many stages with many politicians, and I've just noticed that really up close, as well as in the general political and media sphere, it seems to become impossible for politicians to talk. They don't air an idea. They're increasingly wary about airing a view, and I've been thinking for a while about why this might be. And I mean, one of the views I've come to is just that there's something about the age of social media that's meant that it's too dangerous to think aloud now or to try things out. And in fact, a step down from that, it's become dangerous for people in politics to say what they think. And that's because you're not speaking to a room full of people now. You're speaking to the world at any moment. You could be, as we know from books like John Ronson's, so you've been publicly shamed. I mean, it can happen to an individual from the public. You can just at any moment be broadcasting to the entire population of the planet. Your error will be known by everyone. This has caused this restriction of discussion. And there's one other thing I should add, which is the nature of the media in recent years has been that the idea has been that the public can put up with shorter and shorter time spans. So, you'll go on a discussion if you're a politician or a pundit, and you'll be with someone else and you'll get a total of 4 minutes between you of air time. And the idea about that was that the public can't cope with anything longer, bite-sized nugget. Well, that's not true. And the success of podcasts like this one and many others is showing that actually, we can, as a public, cope with long-form conversation, and we want it. We want meaningful discussion of ideas. We don't want soundbite culture, or not only soundbite culture.
Yeah, like 3-hour podcast with Joe Rogan.
People
stick around for every second.
Joe Rogan is the marathon runner of podcasting, but my gosh, it flies by. He's so good at it. It's so interesting. And I can think of no mainstream media figure who could run a conversation with one guest that could go for 2 or 3 hours.
Jordan Peterson, of course, with whatever he's got, 40 million followers, regularly puts out 2-hour videos. So that's another really good example. Back to the politicians not being able to say anything meaningful. John Roskam and Simon Brenner at your event, the IPA's representatives that you were speaking at the other day, and it really struck them that there's kind of this crazy situation where politicians don't say the truth, don't tell the truth. They know they're not telling the truth, and the people listening know they're not telling the truth. Do you think this led to like Trump and populism and Brexit? Do you think those two things are linked?
I think there is a link to what is going on in politics. I personally reject the term populism. I think it's the wrong term for this. I think populism has become the pejorative term that a lot of people use for things they just don't like.
Yeah.
When the public are wrong, they're populists.
Yeah.
When Hillary Clinton talks about the power of Wall Street, she's not a populist.
Yeah.
Donald Trump talks about the power of Wall Street, he is a populist. So the same person, the same thought can be heard by different people and it's interpreted in a different way. Emmanuel Macron in France didn't run in any normal party structure, created his own movement. It wasn't really even a party. He had to put elected people to run for election after he got the presidency. On any normal term, this would be described as populism.
Yeah.
But it isn't, because Mr. Macron appears to be within a certain acceptable type of politics, or acceptable in quotation marks. So I don't accept the populism term. But yes, I mean, that's going on is that you can't stop us, the public, from thinking. You can stop us from being able to say things sometimes. You can dampen the amount of speech, unfortunately, sadly. You can dampen the amount of speech, but you can't stop people thinking. And what I think is that the Brexit vote, for instance, showed that despite decades of the public being told one thing, they instinctively came out and they said, no, we have another view of our own, and we're going to assert our opportunity to voice that. But I do think there is something going on, and obviously Donald Trump is the ultimate demonstration that the way in which this breaks out might be in just people who can say the most outlandish things ending up winning.
Yeah, or Jeremy Corbyn in the UK can say outlandish things, but there's a level of earnestness to it that people...
Yes, that might be the case. I mean, Corbyn's a different creature. I mean, you could argue he's like, you know, the famous thing of the stopped clock that can be right once every 24 hours. I mean, he's been in politics for almost 40 years, and I mean, he's made absolutely no impact in politics for decades of sitting on the back benches with no piece of legislation to his name, with no meaningful achievements in politics. The most incurious as well as ineffective politician you could imagine. And then he becomes a Labour Party leader. Maybe it was all sorts of things that caused that to happen, but... the thing I think that there's lots of stuff about Corbyn that is meaningless challenges. I mean, it's the things you know you don't have to worry about. The thing you really have to worry about with him, as with all opponents, is where might he be right? Where might he be on to something? And it's almost impossible to locate anything which Jeremy Corbyn is right on. But here is one thing he is on to, which is particularly among young people. They don't just want these bureaucratic politicians who speak this same boring politicese language. They don't want it. Now, Jeremy Corbyn comes with the claim that he's going to make the world fairer and nicer and cuddlier and in every way better, and we're all going to become better people. And now, I think he's not going to achieve that in one legislative term or more.
Yeah, there's no way Pete and I are becoming better people.
No, so, I mean, you'd really have to work on you two, obviously.
It's at least five pieces of legislation.
but the point is that he, you know, to give him credit, he tries to speak to depths. And, you know, that's something I think the right of centre politicians should be thinking about as well. I mean, we don't just want politicians who, when asked about anything meaningful, reply with blandishments and bureaucratic detail. And for all of his faults, Jeremy Corbyn tries to speak to depths, albeit in his case answering with shallows.
So we'll move on. So we mentioned Joe Rogan before. Now, you've been on the Joe Rogan podcast, and one of the things you guys talked about, which I found really interesting, was that there was a video between you and I think it was Sam Harris that got taken down from YouTube after like a community complaint.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like under the idea that it might have been hate speech. Now, obviously, it wasn't hate speech,
but
it was something to do with identity politics. So what is like... what is the effect that identity politics is having? So as someone who's had something taken off YouTube just for the...
Oh, a lot more than that before I answer your question. I mean, Joe Rogan's podcast where we discussed Sam Harris and my discussion making somebody get a tick against them in community guidelines, us discussing that meant that podcast was Joe Rogan's first podcast which had been demonetized by YouTube.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, you know, demonetization isn't the same thing as silencing, but it's very clear... slap on the wrist, and if it was a content provider who didn't have resources behind them or much success, this is a way to quietly silence people. There's a lot of that. I mean, I'm not myself on Facebook, but I occasionally get reports from readers. For instance, I wrote a little while ago about a case of a girl who got, young woman, I should say, who was barred from entering the UK because the previous time she had set up a stall with leaflets saying Allah is gay. And I said, this is an outrageous, whatever your thoughts on this matter, this is an outrageous infringement of free speech. People shouldn't be barred from countries for effectively blasphemy reasons. And I wrote a piece at The Spectator in the UK starting with a line, you know, is Allah gay? And I said, I think it's highly unlikely that if such a being as Allah existed, he would be solely gay. He would probably be bi-curious or something, or sort of gender fluid, probably. But I said this, and I started getting reports from readers that they had been suspended from Facebook, some cases for months, for reposting this article. So this stuff really worries me because I'm lucky, I have a voice, I have outlets and so on, but I think that the impact on members of the public who just want to share, I mean, it's not like this is crazy content, it's just, you know, it's mainstream stuff. The idea that this gets described by the social media companies as being, you know, really troublesome sort of stuff, you know, I'm sorry, but these people have more power than they know how to safely deal with, and this is very troubling. As for the content of your question, which was, you'll have to remind me now.
Just like the effect that identity politics is having.
Well, it's making us mad.
Yeah, exactly.
It's making us mad.
Yeah.
It worries me immensely. It's because you can see the examples of the insanity all around. I mean, this country's got as good a dose of that as anyone. The real problem about it is that it's fragmenting people. It's you can feel it. I think it's going to make people retreat into tribes of all sorts of kinds. Because the thing with identity politics is that people can play it back at you, you know. It's quite hard to see how to avoid it. You can't just have one group having identity politics. And at some point, I think this could get very, very nasty indeed. So I just... It's something I've been thinking and writing about a lot recently. I want people to stop this, but it's not enough to just point out the absurdities. You've got to provide the answers.
You've said, I think the idea of, in reference to America, you know, rather than sort of different groups in society and looking out for their own interests, we've lost sight of this idea, and I'll quote you, I think the idea is sort of looking out for each other. That's surely the point of the Republic, and that point seems to have been lost. It's sort of what we're touching on here. Is that something that's possible to get back? And if it is, how do we do that?
I think it is, although the obvious ways in which that be got back are all unpalatable. I mean, the obvious way to have more sort of civic pride is war. I mean, Britain, America, and to some extent Australia have been running off the moral gains of World War II for a very long time now, and I think they've diminished, they've fallen off. Jonathan Haidt has mentioned this, among others, in his research. It's not obvious how you create it in a what is hopefully peacetime. One of the things you can do, I think, is to point people to the dangers of where they are going. I do think you need to deconstruct the deconstructionists. You need to take it apart. And I mean, let me put it this way: the identity politics people and the intersectionalists who come from this have got this idea that basically if you line everyone up, society will fit in like that, like a sort of beautiful sort of piece of Lego or something, you know. And you'll get the gays and the women and black people and people of other racial minorities and people of other sexual minorities and so on, and these people have been, so, and the whole thing will just beautifully meld like that. And I think there's already a massive amount of evidence. I mean, witness the so-called turf wars between trans-exclusionary radical feminists and other branches of feminism. I mean, if you were wishing them well, you'd be really worried at this point. But they're coming in like every other thing at this kind of angle, and so this thing isn't going to happen. It's coming in like this, and it's just causing and is going to cause the most ungodly mess for years. I mean, you can see, as I say, in these corners of the debate, the pain that's already existing, and it's just going to get worse because it doesn't work. It doesn't work. There are too many internal contradictions, among other things. I mean, just the internal contradictions are everywhere. They're so visible, you know. I mean, starting from the thing of, like, who's your leader? Who appoints the leader of this community? Who's the authority? Yeah. And, you know, we have this in the UK with, like every other country, with so-called, you know, representatives of various groups. And I really resent this because I think your representatives are only the people who are representatives because they've been voted for. So when people say to me, you know, who are the Muslim leaders? I say, well, I mean, it's the Muslims who we've elected as MEPs, members of the European Parliament, for instance, the Muslims who are members of Parliament in the upper house and the House of Commons, many other realms of politics. Those would be the people. Why would a sort of self-appointed council of backwards people like we have in the UK and the Muslim Council of Britain and other things, why should those people be regarded as being leaders? Nobody voted for them. And, I mean, that thing goes with every other movement. Self-professed leaders who have you know, no qualities of leadership, not least because they have no followers.
Yeah, so you talk about how there's people without a platform right now who are feeling the brunt of identity politics because they don't want to speak. And you talked about how you yourself, you have a platform, Joe Rogan has a platform, even if he gets one video demonetized, it's okay. Yeah. But do you sort of feel like there are people out there who are going to take any word that you say, any word that Joe Rogan says, maybe even in this interview, and they're just going to use like one particular quote, go nuts with it, and have you shut down through that? Is there like an element of self-censorship of even the big players in the media right now that's identity politics is starting to affect?
Well, I actually, on Sunday with Sam Harris, I was discussing some of this because I think it's hard not to sort of self-censor in some way in this era. Because, let me put it this way, everyone who's a writer or speaker, thinker, public figure in any way, you're basically trained, you train yourself or you're trained to learn to write and speak in such a fashion that an honest person cannot honestly misrepresent you. That what you said is faithfully understood by decent people acting in a decent manner. And the era of social media, among other things, has caused something different to happen, which is that many people are now having to write and think and speak in a manner that ensures that a dishonest critic cannot dishonestly misrepresent you. And there's a problem from this, which is it's not possible to do that. Yeah. It's not possible. It's not possible for me to use a word we've all agreed on the meaning of, and for somebody else to either say the word means something else, or, and this is a very common one, it's not the words you say, it's what we think's behind the words. And you hear that all the time at the moment in every direction. It's
the dog whistle element.
Yeah, yeah, the dog whistle. I mean, you know, with the old counter to which is, you know, you've got to be the dog to hear the whistle.
Exactly.
But these sort of voluntary dogs that crop up all across our media, who claim to have the power of hearing for this, they're everywhere. And this is incredibly dangerous because I could attribute all sorts of motives to people that their words don't reveal. But I don't, because I think it's dishonest, and you can't have any form of communication across political or other lines if that's the game you're going to play. And I think we have to fight against this very, very hard. You know, what was one of the great things that Elizabeth I said, but the observation of not being willing to look into the heart of human beings, not being able to, not claiming that you can see into the hearts of people. Because, first of all, you can't. Secondly, that way lies hell, because everyone can play that game. I can claim that all my critics are guided by some horrible bigotry, but I wouldn't, because I don't think it's true, and I don't want to claim it for short-term political gain. I think it'd be an incredibly dishonest thing to do. And so I think that, among other things, one of the ways you get out of that is to do what something which I think the first person I came across who pointed this out was Roger Kimball of the New Criterion in New York. He's pointed out, I think it was him who pointed out first, that the only way to undo some of this is for there to be an equal societal punishment for somebody erroneously making a claim, as there should be for the person against whom such a claim is accurate. So, for instance, if somebody is actually shown to be a racist, for instance, very, very racist person, you can see it from their words and their actions and so on, then that person will rightly suffer societal shame. But the people who, for short-term political benefit of their own or for career advancement, make such claims when they're wrong, should, I think, equally suffer consequences from that. In the same way that if you ran around the city claiming that everyone you disliked, you had evidence that they were a paedophile, if it turned out that you had no such evidence and you were simply saying it because you didn't like the people in question, you would and should suffer serious societal stigma for lying, for telling untruths, for poisoning your society with untruths. And I think we have to find some way to do that.
I think there would be about 5 accounts left on Twitter once we went through and removed all the people that erroneously make those claims.
Yes. Yeah. It would probably shut Twitter down.
Yeah. I think they'd have to completely restructure their financial plan because they love those kind of mobs. So next question. So like you talked about how you're about to ride on this and you're thinking about how do we solve it. Are there any sort like apart from the equal going back at them? Are there any other ways you think we can start to peel back against identity politics?
Well, one thing is something which de Tocqueville is very helpful on, among others, which is the nature of face-to-face interaction in the democracy, which is, again, I mean, I don't want to harp on about social media, but that's obviously part of the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm here, you know, part of this week, as I say, talking with Dr. Cornel West. And we have many, many disagreements on all sorts of areas. And we'll, I hope, flesh some of them out. But I also hope we'll do so in a civilized manner because I have significant respect for him and we seem to have got on quite well so far. I hope these aren't famous last words.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in a way, it's an example of what I want to show people we should be doing. Because, you see, it's very easy to be brave and rude at a million miles distance. It's harder to actually interact with people face to face, particularly if you disagree with them. And we have entered this famous echo chamber problem. And I can see it. I mean, I don't engage on social media partly for precisely this reason, but I can see that I look sometimes at what people do, and I look at adults, significant people, sometimes people who used to be serious, who are on Twitter just. And let me give you a very quick example. Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's former communications chief, a very brilliant communications chief, you could say, and so on. And he was tweeting last week against a man who's a UKIP donor. And Alistair Campbell was tweeting about this guy's moobs. He was saying, oh, his moobs, he's a moob, and they're probably Russian moobs, his moob skis. I was just saying, Jesus, what happened? But there he was doing this, and, you know, 24 hours later, he was on the same platform talking about the fact there's too little respect in public dialogue and discourse. And you think, well, you've either got your moob skis wrapped or you've got the call for respect in dialogue, but you can't have both, you thought. Now, why does he have both? Probably because he's on this platform where, like these other people, they sort of forget they're speaking to the world. They disgrace themselves. And we've got to be able to return to this idea of there being a form of private language, like a joke, a private joke. There are things you'd say to your mates you wouldn't say on Twitter. A lot of people have come a cropper for forgetting that. But this is why the issue of face-to-face interaction is so important, because there are some people, I have many, many enemies in my life, and I'm sure we'll make many more in the years ahead, and I'm very proud of some of them, and some of them have been very, very good enemies, people like Julian Assange and Tariq Ramadan.
I was going to ask who your favourite was.
Well, they're all in prison, I have to say. Yeah.
So don't get on your bad side.
No, I mean, it's very striking. It's the list is it. They're all in detention or awaiting trial. You make enemies because there are some things that are points of absolute contention which you cannot agree on. And you can have that out as civilly as you can, but there are things that are very, very important to assert and that you're going to make opponents in. But by and large, one of my feelings about face-to-face interactions with people is that it's much harder to dislike people. It's much harder to be really vicious to people if you're sitting front of people. I mean, the things that people say on Twitter about people's private lives, you would never say to somebody's face, and quite right too.
Yeah, especially the moobs comment. Oh, yeah, that's my armchair psychiatrist thing, but I think that it's just the action of tweeting something and you're only seeing a phone. Like, you don't see the person's face screw up when they read it. Whereas,
right,
like, if you're face-to-face and you say you're a racist or you got
right
this thing.
I had an example of this recently when I bumped into somebody at an event who I never met, who used to be at a piss-poor publication, who said, oh, yeah, you threatened to sue me once. And I said, I don't threaten to sue people very often. And I said, you know, and he was sort of very jolly about it. It was disgusting. I said, oh, what was it over? And he told me, and he said, I'd sort of forgotten about the incident. And I said, well, you published an untruth, and then you had to unpublish it, didn't you, and correct it and apologize. He's like, yeah, sorry about that. It's like, and that's sort of not uncommon. There's a frivolity with some people who think, I'll just go out there and say crazy stuff about people and just get some attention and so on. And I looked at this guy and I just thought, what a contemptible figure you have to be to think that's a decent way to operate. I thought, my gosh, if I'd run a piece making some disgusting and untrue and libelous accusation against you, I bet I wouldn't. I'd slink away if I saw you, you know? But there's a shamelessness with some people.
All right, let's change tack slightly. Obviously, you've written the book, The Strange Death of Europe, where you talk a lot about culture in Europe.
Yeah.
You talk about how people in Europe find it difficult to, in some circumstances, even admit that they have a culture, that there is a European culture. Or if they do admit that there's a European culture, that it's a negative thing. Why is that? And we'll get on to Australia in a sec, but...
Well, Australia is connected to that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm very connected to that. And I've seen that already in my time here. You know, I'm a great advocate of self-criticism as an individual and for societies. I think self-critical societies are a very good thing, much better than the opposite. Yeah. But self-criticism has to be fair to yourself as well. It can't be masochistic. It really shouldn't be masochistic. It really shouldn't be. Apart from anything else, because you end up producing people who think that because you're in a self-critical society, the worst things that are said about your society are true, and therefore the other societies who are not self-critical, who you don't hear things from, you can kind of give a pass to. I mean, I worry about this all the time about coverage of Russia, for instance. I think there's a branch of conservatism in particular which is far too uncritical of Russia. And I think this is one reason for that. You know, we live in these messy, diverse and pluralistic and democratic societies, and you can hear all sorts of stuff about us. And then there are these sort of countries which don't have to have, you know, those messy things like elections and so on. And it's sort of easy for people to fall... Well, it's too easy for some people to fall into... a form of almost admiration, quasi-admiration. And I think it's the same thing with China. And I just think we should avoid the worst tendencies of this. And I suppose it comes down to that central thing. You know, I mean, it came up in the discussion in Sydney on Sunday, but, you know, I'm all for people feeling that there are remaining inequalities because of historical events. I'm all for people trying to work out how to deal with that. I'm not for self-annihilation as the answer. You know, I'm not for instance, I don't think an obvious solution to ongoing racial issues in the US is, for instance, for some kind of tithe to be taken from everyone who's white or of European descent in America and distributed among the black population as, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates and others have recently argued. I think there's a new type of hell you're going to create if you go down that route. But I'm all for answers. But this sort of thing that's going on, and you hear it here, I think, as well, it's going to tell some people, it has been telling some people, that they are uniquely guilty. And my view is that no people on earth have ever been entirely guilty, and no people on earth have ever been entirely innocent. And in any case, we get back to this central conundrum, which I address a bit in one chapter in the book, in The Tyranny of Guilt, which is, how do you solve it? Like, what are your suggestions for solving this, and how do you expiate it? So, you know, there's something which I didn't actually end up putting in the book, but which Nietzsche is very good on, which is having what happens in societies which effectively have the structure of Christianity but lack the belief. And one of the things that you can get into in that, and I think this is the case in Australia, I think it is the case in my own country and across much of Europe, is you get into the problem of guilt with no potential possibility for redemption ever. Yeah. No means of redemption. Germany is the obvious example. this is living memory. But like, what is your attitude to be to young Germans who themselves have never done anything and whose parents may not have done anything and whose grandparents may? What is your answer in a country of 80 million people, most of whom are descended from the generation of that war? It's not clear to me, but I know that there is a lot of damage that you could do if you kept telling Germans that, whereas generally we don't believe people are responsible for the sins of their fathers, they should be. Because it suggests, among other things, for instance, that there's something in the DNA, something in the blood in Germany, that every now and then turns them genocidal. And that's a kind of Nazi idea, that there are historical traits within people that erupt like that. I don't like this deterministic view. It's you could almost say it's Calvinistic.
Yeah, that feeds on to the next one. So you talk about how they look for ways to sort of make up for past guilt. And one of the ways that you mention in the book is through like this sort of race, I guess, to have the most inclusive immigration policy,
sure.
Especially through Germany. Is that why you see Germany being the most open in terms of immigration?
Yeah, I mean, I was speaking the other week at a conference with an Austrian scientist from Austria. And at one point he asked me about this and he said, why do you think they did it? And I said, it was because of the war. And he said, which war? And I said, the Second World War. He burst out laughing. And I realized it was one of those things that like, it's so obvious that he just hadn't thought this recently.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's not like big events like that are just going to go away in 70 years. And as I say, I mean, I'm not for eternal and constant guilt. I think we have to find ways, as I say, a means of redemption. But I think that the 2015 decisions by Angela Merkel and the weird frisson underneath it in Germany definitely had this. There was a quasi-orgiastic pleasure in the sight of people trying to come into Germany rather than get out. Breaking through the borders to get into Germany rather than breaking through the borders to get out. I can understand it, of course. Who couldn't understand that? But you know, it doesn't... I mean, there are many paradoxes and oddities about this, but not the least of them is this thing that the rising anti-Semitism issue in Germany now, because of the rising migration and particularly the Muslim immigration into Germany, means that a German minister a few months ago had to say, you know, we don't want more anti-Semites in Germany. It's pretty good policy to have, that would seem. It's not as we know, it's been historically a country that's lacked in anti-Semites. So the mass importation of more would not be an obvious a German policy strategy. But you know, there are things like that happen, which can be completely clearly foretold, as I did. I said this would happen. You can foretell these things and you can act on them if you only have the conversation about them. But we just have not allowed ourselves to have the conversation. I said this on Australian television last night. Like, I don't know what Australia's policies should be on immigration. I'm not clear on it. I've got some ideas. I've certainly got a lot of ideas of what you shouldn't do. And I think that some of the things which your governments have done in recent years have been very wise, particularly deciding that the difference between legal and illegal immigration matters. But all I really know is that you, like the rest of us, have to be able to have a much deeper conversation about this. You know, you can have that because of infrastructure concerns, too swift a growth of population and not having the structure as a society to deal with it this fast. You could have it on financial terms, you could have it on welfare state terms, you could have it on identity terms. But basically, the conversation here seems to me, like everywhere else, that on one side, this debate is just massively restricted because of allegations that are frivolously made.
So you mentioned since you got here that you've noticed sort of manifestations of the guilt that you talked about in Europe, in Australia, and you did sort of point out as Australia in particular in the book as a place that sort of suffered from this guilt over their culture. I just want to explain that a little bit and talk through what you've noticed and what your thoughts are on that.
Well, a little bit of this came up the other day because of the... I knew about this already, but the first time I'd seen it was the thanking of the tribes on whose land the venue was. And there was an interesting question about this offered to the host, who's a local. And somebody said, what was the reason for that? Somebody from the audience. And, you know, and he said, well, look, I think at this stage it's such a common practice that I think it's a pointed thing not to do it, which I thought was fascinating. I hadn't realized that had become the default, as it were. And I mean, again, aspects of that seem, you know, healthy enough. It's only if you tell people that, as I say, here's the thing, just you can't treat groups of people as if they're lesser. And, you know, I said to a friend the other day, something you notice doesn't happen, or at least I think doesn't happen so much anymore, is people talking about classes of people as if they are indeed like homogenous entities. You know, I mean, if somebody said to me, I think the aristocracy are just great, I'd say, but who are you talking about? Yeah. Who? I can think of some aristocrats who are terrific and enormous philanthropists and brilliant businessmen and have done all sorts of good. I can think of many who are dullards and dimwits and selfish and stupid and much more. If somebody said to me, I love the working class, I'd be like, who? Who are you talking about? It's madness to talk about groups of people in this way. And it should be the same in other areas as well. I'd be like, if somebody said, I just love gay people, I'd be like, why? Why particularly? Like, and who? You can't think of anyone who's gay who's not great? I love women. It's crazy to do this. Yet there is this thing that is returning about this within racial and group identity. I love X group, or X group is better in some way than this other group. I don't know, it's early stages of it, but in some way I just have this fear that race is back. A really... in a way that can be stopped from getting ugly. I really do think that. But it just seems to be on the agenda in a way that it didn't used to be when I was growing up in a very diverse and pluralistic part of London. It's and I think it's back because there is an over push by some minorities, which is causing a counter push to begin. And I think that just has to be, look, it's not going to be answered. It just has to be thought about and trodden in very, very carefully.
If I can go back to when you said how people are just trying not to have the debate about immigration, and I think that's especially true in Europe. You've got, and then poll after poll, as you cite in the book, poll after poll shows that immigration is a serious concern for a lot of people. And the political class just wants to talk about anything but. So, like, you know, whatever someone's view on immigration may be, if they listen to the podcast or watching this video, I think it's extremely interesting that you have such a incredibly divisive issue in the public, and they want to talk about it, but they're not hearing it from the political class. Why is the political class running so far away from this?
Somebody involved in politics some time ago made a really interesting observation to me that I hadn't thought of before. And they said to me, there's something you've got fundamentally wrong, Douglas, and I'm always quite interested to hear that. And I was persuaded by their argument. This person said to me, look, you think, because you're motivated by a sort of search for truth, or at least an interest, I'd put it no more in truth, no stronger, you think that that's what's motivating other people too. But a lot of people are not motivated by that, or end up not being motivated for that. And this person said, in politics, you may go into it motivated by that, but particularly the higher up you go, there is this issue of effectively cost-benefit analysis. And when I thought about this, I thought this just rang really true. So take some of the issues I have written about a lot, like immigration, like, for instance, Islam. If you know that one side of this spectrum can lead to total career death, the end of your jobs, the end of your reputation, let alone if it also means the actual threat of death, I mean actual violence against you, or at least a serious restriction in your ability to move. And on the other hand, if you got it wrong, at worst, like, I'll write a piece being critical of you. A couple of other people will call you out. Like, whichever side is true or whichever side is false, like, what do you think the motivation is more towards? Okay? And this is an explanation for a lot of things that go on. In order to correct that, because it's important to have answers, you have to in some way rebalance that. There has to be a reward for telling the truth. And concomitantly, there has to be some greater punishment for lying or for telling lies. Or, and this is perhaps more pertinent, there should be some kind of downside to not wishing to pursue truth in the public square. And look, politics has never been a bloodless game, I mean, metaphorically speaking, sometimes literally. It's never been totally clean. It's always going to attract a certain type of psychopath. Yeah. Okay, it just is. The late Oberon War used to say that anyone who said they wanted to be in politics should be prevented from being in politics by virtue of their ambition.
Well, that's what we told former Deputy Executive James Patterson before he got into politics, that, you know,
yeah, and he didn't listen to us then. No. And won't listen to us now.
But, you know, it is a... as I say, one can't be kind of halcyon days about it, but you can push things a bit better in one direction in this, and I think the direction I would like to see things move in is some reward for taking risks, you know, or at least less punishment for taking risks. There's a woman called Sarah Champion who's the Labour MP for Rotherham, which is the place where 1,500 girls were raped by minority ethnic gangs of Muslim men, an issue which has been happening in many, many other cities across the UK and is a source of unbelievable angst and pain, as well as just nightmarish horror for thousands of young girls. Look, when Sarah Champion said, 10 years after this had all been found out by an official inquiry, when she said, she's a Labour MP and was in the shadow cabinet, when she said, look, we've got to address this question, she got fired from the shadow cabinet. This is only last year. Now, that's outrageous. She didn't say anything beyond the facts, she didn't exaggerate anything, she didn't start bashing minorities in general, she was very specific about a just unimaginable thing that had happened in her own constituency. And if an MP cannot talk about something like that, who the hell can? She lost her position in the party for that. Now, that's got to be wrong. It's got to be wrong. I'm not a supporter of the Labour Party, certainly not under Jeremy Corbyn, but any healthy political party cannot operate like that.
Because it also tells every other politician, if they see anything like that, just don't bring it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I mean, concomitantly, we've got to find a way to make sure the people who did are respected for that. And, you know, there was an MP, she's now sadly retired from politics, but a Labour MP called Anne Cryer, who, my gosh, there's an admirable person. She was onto this when nobody else was. She really, really tried to raise the alarm on this, and people didn't want to listen, and she was called every type of slur. And she had to be protected by the police at one period. But there is an admirable person.
Bringing back to the tour that you're on now, so you're with Brett and Eric Weinstein, Sam Harris, Manjun Nawaz. There's the sort of, like, I think it's been now called the intellectual dark web, pretty worldwide. That to me is really interesting, the way that speakers such as yourself or those guys, and then you know you can add in Jordan Peterson, Joe Rogan, etc. You can reach anyone, anywhere, at any time, on any device that they want. Are you sort of seeing this as like the start of a counter-revolution to the identity politics ways, the new ideas that are out there?
It's something is changing. Something is changing. There's several obvious signs to me. One is that thing of the long-form discussion, as we were saying, the long podcast, taking over from the, you know, it turns out we can cope with more than 3 minutes of speaking, and we don't have to have this dumbed down media, we don't have to have people treating us all like kids, you know, we can cope with ideas, we can cope with nuance. I think that that's one sign that's persuading me. Another thing I have to say is not just the attractiveness of live events these days, which you people weren't foreseeing that 10 or 15 years ago, but also the demographic. I did an event a few weeks ago in Dublin and then one in London with Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, and I think we had about 10,000 people at each event, and they were in, well, basically in rock stadiums. And
yeah, the O2 Arena, I think.
The O2 Arena, yeah, in London. And yeah, I mean, look, it's the more striking thing of this is it's young people predominantly. It's young people who are very smart, very engaged, very diverse. It's not, as the press keep wanting to claim, some kind of like alt-right, you know. And in fact, very interesting, the other day in Sydney, Eric Weinstein, who coined the term intellectual dark web, said near the beginning of the first event, he said to the audience, shout out if you're here from the alt-right. Silence. Shout out now if you're a woman. Way. Shout out now if you're left of center. Way from the crowd. Okay? Why did he do it? Because, as he said, you'll bet your bottom dollar there will be a journalist there, or usually not there, who will say, gateway drugs to alt-right, Douglas Murray, Brett Weinstein, etc., etc., Sam Harris, notorious far-right-wing fundamentalist, yesterday had a rally in Sydney.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And they'll take, like, the fact that no one said it's alt-right. It's like, well, gateway drug, as he
said. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Done it at the end of the day. Yeah, they exactly. All have risen up as one with their tiki torches. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's pathetic, this. And, of course, that is... It's a way to not deal with the issue. Now, this reminds me of quite a lot of things going on at the moment, but... One obvious one is very much irritates me. I don't talk about Brexit or Trump very much, mainly because the rest of the world is talking about them. But one thing that is worth pointing out about both of these phenomena is look at the wasted opportunity of their opponents in the last couple of years. If you were an opponent of Brexit, you could have spent the last 2 years helping your country to get out of the European Union in a really good way that was beneficial for everyone, because we've got to leave because we voted to leave. Okay, you can respect the mandate. It's not at all obvious to me that the best use of your time for 2 years is to pretend that because of four Russian bots on Twitter, the British people were tricked into voting to leave the European Union, which is a botherless and unbothersome organization with no downsides and only upsides. And you know, how could we be so mad? Well, we were deranged by something on Twitter. It seems to me to be an awful waste of everyone's time, that. If in America you were a Democrat who just cannot believe that Hillary Clinton lost the election because she was such an attractive candidate, such a fresh face in politics, if that was your view, then the last 18 months, you could have really worked out what went wrong. Like, why did the most spend ever on an election to deliver a candidate to the White House fail so badly that they lost to Donald Trump? Like, what are the things you're not speaking about which he spoke to and got the necessary thousands, tens of thousands, it wasn't a big margin of people to come over and vote for him on. You could have spent the time working that out. What have you got instead? This magnificent, I think, waste of time that the whole thing was stolen. Now, I don't know what they'll find in terms of investigation. It just seems to me unwise not to accept the mandate and to not be trying to regroup and work out what you need to do. And I think it's the same thing with this thing, the criticisms that Jordan and I and others get. It's like, stop trying to pretend that we're trying to do something we're not. Consider the fact that we might be onto something, or at least not onto nothing. You know, and it's not, people aren't turning out and, you know, absorbing this content because they're mad or because they're bigots. It's because there are a set of really, really big things that need to be addressed. And you can't just shut us all up. You can't just tell us not to think. You know, you can't pretend that there's no difference between chromosomes and just make us all agree with it, or that there's no difference between men and women, or that the most important characteristic of people is their gender identity or their sexual identity. Then you can't tell people that they're terrible because of the colour of their skin and a whole load of other stuff. You can't just do that and not expect people to want to have a more honest conversation about that. Now, there was a time until quite recently when you could lie and get away with it. And I don't think it's possible anymore. And I said this to Brett Weinstein, even 15 years ago, if a left-wing campus in America had decided to basically smear somebody and pretend that they're something they're not, they could have got away with it. But today, people can find out for themselves. They can find out, actually, this is a Bernie Sanders-supporting Democrat who they're trying to pretend is some kind of, like, alt-right neo-Nazi. You know, and this is not rare. The New York Times has tried it repeatedly. New York Times has done a number of attempts to take this thing out, and people can see for themselves. They try to pretend that Jordan's use of the term enforced monogamy, which is a term that's been used in the New York Times before because it's a noted term that had some noted meaning and agreed upon meaning, that actual fact his use of this term means that Jordan Peterson wants to, like, get incels and force women to have sex with them, when anyone can at any time go and see what he was talking about for them and find out for themselves. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know where this all goes, but I think it's an attempt. I think people are attempting to stop us getting this out or misrepresenting what we're saying. And I think they shouldn't, because among other things, they are missing an opportunity to listen to something that perhaps they should listen to.
Douglas Murray, the book is The Strange Death of Europe. Go out and buy a copy now. Douglas Murray, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Brilliant.
Okay, that was our interview with Douglas Murray. Sorry, that was a really fun chat. Pete, do you have any reflections on it?
Well, yeah, my favourite bit was obviously the bit at the end where we talked about optimism and, you know, his hopes for the future, and how, sort of a bit like Brendan O'Neill, how there, this kind of divide between the elites and popular and ordinary people is actually a cause for optimism, and particularly his work with young people. When he talks to young people, he realises that there is hope for the future. So that was pretty fantastic. I'm an optimistic guy, so that appealed to me.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things from that interview for me was him and Jordan Peterson selling out O2 in the UK.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, if you guys aren't big music people, like, O2 is a huge arena.
Yeah.
Monty Python did their farewell tour at the O2. Like, that is how big Jordan Peterson and the intellectual dark web, for want of a better term.
Yeah.
That's how big these guys are.
And their popularity.
Like, that is rock star big.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And their popularity is what he's sort of optimistic
yeah,
about.
Yeah, exactly. I really like the start, the stuff at the start, and we put a Facebook video of this 2-minute stretch out when he starts talking about how people are populist when the political elite disagree with them. Like, politicians, if they say something and they politically disagree, those are populist. but everyone else is principled.
Yeah, exactly.
So when Donald Trump says Wall Street's got too much power, populist. When Hillary Clinton does, she's just taking a nuanced political stance on a very important issue.
And Macron, like Macron's a total populist.
Yeah, I that was one of the things I wanted to bring up, was just like Macron can't be a populist because, as we know,
he's pro-EU.
No, he's pro-EU, and also his thoughts are too complex for journalists to put down. Remember that quote?
Yeah,
can't be a populist if your thoughts are too complex like that.
Well, that was quite a scary moment for me, actually, because I was the one who asked that question, and he was like, well, actually, I have a problem with the term populist. Mm. I was like, just please don't hurt me.
Yeah.
Just sort of fixed me with
that
the
would
stare,
have been very populist for him to hurt you.
Yeah, oh, I know.
That would have really fired up the people.
I don't think so. The paper would have been
would have been banging down the hotel door. All right, so let's get into some stories that made us laugh around. This is a weird one. Like, it's not exactly a ha-ha kind of story, but it is very interesting. So you guys might remember, I think it was like 2 months ago, Scarlett Johansson took the role of
July,
that is 1 month ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I was close.
Yeah.
I was off by 1 month.
You're pretty close.
Thank you. So Scarlett Johansson took the role of a transgender man in an upcoming film called Rub and Tug. And it was like a real story of a guy. She took the role.
I didn't realize that was what it was called.
That's what it's called.
So
grow up.
Behave yourself, everyone.
Behave yourself, mate. So that's what the movie's called. So took the role. Immediate Twitter storm. How dare, you know, a cisgender white woman take the role of a transgender man?
Yeah.
You know, no one's seen the performance yet. Like, no one's like, well, you know, actors are paid to play people that aren't them.
Yeah.
So shouldn't we wait till we see it?
Yeah.
Huge Twitter storm. And, you know, Scarlett Johansson eventually turned down the role, making sure that absolutely no one's going to see this film, and also people that aren't on their side are going to go, I'm not really sure about those kind of activists.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's got worse now. So Ruby Rose got cast as Batwoman, this upcoming film. Ruby Rose, Australian actress.
Yeah, Aussie
might have seen her. Yeah, John Wick 2 she was in. She was in a few other films. So she quit Twitter after her announcement of Batwoman came out. Because Twitter decided she wasn't gay enough to play Batwoman. Like, it's a lesbian superhero. She doesn't classify herself as a strictly lesbian. Therefore, she can't play Batwoman because Batwoman's a lesbian.
Yeah. Well, like, there's an element of this that's like she's ours, like she's Aussie Ruby. So it's like, don't you pick on our Aussie Ruby.
Well, just don't pick on Ruby Rose in general.
Yeah,
I don't care. She could be from any country in the world. But it's very sad that she had to delete her Twitter because of the crap that's coming out. But just from stepping back, it is so funny to me the knots people tie themselves in to remove themselves from cultural appropriation. Like, if you have to strictly be a lesbian to play a lesbian superhero, there's nothing in your worldview that can allow you to play someone who's a lesbian unless you're a lesbian themselves.
Yeah, it's terrible. This thing to me is more kind of, you know, sad than hilarious. And she said, what did she say when she quit? You know, I came out when I was 12 and now people are telling me I'm not lesbian enough.
Yeah.
You know, I'm done. Yeah. See you later, Twitter.
I'm done. Yeah, well, you know, anyone that deletes Twitter, by the way, to me, good stuff.
Yeah.
The less people that are on that, the better.
We have to be on it for work, so don't blame us.
Sorry, we need to get the stories out there. So, as I said in Hey Yesterday, Hollywood is in deep trouble next time they have to cast a Nazi in a film.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You know, they can't do the stereotypical old British white actor.
Yeah.
Like, they need an actual Nazi now.
There you go.
They've played their own hand.
Yeah.
So look out for that one. I also thought, how do we reboot Terminator now?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's going to be a very hard one to cast. Like, I don't know a whole lot of cyborgs from the future that have been sent back in time to protect someone.
No.
Like, I just don't know how we cast that role.
No, they're all trouble as well.
Yeah. Also, if we ever do a live action Casper the Ghost.
Exactly.
Like, do we have to kill someone? Like, how are we going to get a ghost to play someone?
Yeah.
Yeah. These are all the questions I need to really get to the bottom of.
This is the problem these people haven't thought through.
Yeah. So until we sign off on killing someone so that they can play Casper, I don't, like, these people still have territories to conquer,
exactly,
is my point. Or they can just say actors are paid to portray people that they are not. So therefore, everyone can act.
Yeah.
Is my point. Cool. So that's it for the show this week. Thank you to Douglas Murray for that wonderful interview. Thank you to, Douglas Murray is still in Australia. I think he's now in New Zealand, but he's coming back to Brisbane. He's with Think Inc., that organization. So if you're listening in New Zealand, go to Think Ink website. I think there might still be tickets for the event down there. Mm-hmm. And if you're in Brisbane, I think there are still tickets for the event that's still yet to happen. I think it's sometime next week. I can't remember, but it's linked to in Hay. So go to Think Ink. Thank you to them for helping us set up that interview.
Yes, thank you for their help.
So go to their website, book a ticket. You can hear more from Douglas Murray. So, and thank you to our listeners for subscribing to this podcast. Really appreciate it. So we're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, our website and Podbean. So any of those ones that you prefer, any of those ones that your friends might or family might prefer to listen to, if they want to get involved, you can direct them to any of those. We just ask, if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star rating. Really helps us out with the rankings, because we need to get to number 2 or number 1 just to stick it to the Great Books of Literature podcast, which I'm also on. So like, I don't know why I'm so I don't know why I'm so antagonistic.
You need to decide what team you're on, mate.
Yeah, maybe I'm on this team when I'm on this podcast, and then next Great Books we record, I just start talking smack about this podcast.
Well, you certainly are.
I'm my own Romeo and Juliet situation. Yeah, like I'm on both sides.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. But I was fine with the other podcast. It's Nina that's poisoned my mind with her.
The balcony scene would be a workout for me if I'm both of them. But anyway, sorry.
That's it. That was all I had.
Yeah. The Nina is the patient zero of all of the antagonism here.
Mm. Hi.
Good response. Cool. Are we done?
No. Yep, we're done.
We're not done. Nina, the patient zero of antagonism.
Yes.
So if people want to become a member of the IPA, if they want to financially support us, if they like the podcast, they like Dan's report, they want to see more people like Douglas Murray come on the show and do stuff with the IPA, where can people go if they want to financially support the IPA?
Well, just visit the website, ipadog.au, and click on the join button or the donations button if you want to donate instead. And starting as low as $22 per year, you'll become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia. And remember, this podcast only be happening because of you.
All right, cool. See you guys next week.
See you later.